Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Now, I might want to shut that door. I don't think we'll get to eat in exactly an hour. So if y'all, I know it's starting to smell really good. So y'all pay attention to me. You might want to not have any diversions here. Let's see, Daryl knows. Okay, I guess this is payback for Brother Joey. He's filled in for a couple of my needs at North Little Rock, so I'm happy to be here. And you're going to get a rerun. This was a talk I put together a few weeks, a month or so ago, basically entitled The Merchants of Tarshish. And typically I don't do advertisements, but for those of you that don't subscribe to the Bible Magazine, I would suggest that you do. Everything I got out of this for this lecture came pretty much from this booklet. This was published back in July of 07. That was all the articles in that particular publication were on the Merchants of Tarshish. And basically, this came up, or the reason I decided to take this topic was because even in North Little Rock, an elder one day said, you know, how can we reconcile who the merchants of Tarshish are? Who is the Tarshish of the Bible? So, you know, when you have an older individual, you know, asking the question again sometimes, then maybe we want to make sure that we can reassure from the young to the old who exactly Tarshish is and show that it is something that we can biblically as well as historically through archaeological evidence and historical evidence prove who Tarshish of the Bible exactly is. So we then ask the first question, who is Tarshish? Okay, let's go to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis chapter 10, and we'll look at verse 4. And Genesis 10:4 reads, the sons of Jabin were Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. So here we see Tarshish being a son of Jabin. Okay, what's interesting now, if we go to look at the definition of this individual, Jabin, his name means effervescing, that is, either hot or active. A form of the word is also Java, and this is the name of a son of Joktan, of which the race of the Ionians or the Greeks descended from him. And even Orts, this area of Java, or that is considered the territory of the Greeks and the Ionians. Okay. Now what's interesting is, a lot of times we talk about people and we talk about where they live. Well, then, can we use scripture to prove, to show that, you know, typically where men live is where they call the name of those places. Let's look at Psalms 49:11. This is a good verse to use for any application, whether you're talking about Tarshish or any other place or family name in the Bible, and trying to determine where they resided. Okay, Psalm 49, verse 11. Or actually, I'm going to read verse 1 first, then 10, 11. Hear this, all ye people, give ear, all ye inhabitants of the world. For he seeth that wise men die, likewise the fool and the brutish. Now, verse 10. Now, he seeth that the wise men die, likewise the fool and the brutish person perish and leave their wealth to others. Their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever and their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. So, and this is a common thing that men do, is calling their lands after their own names. Let's also go to Daniel 8, verse 21. Okay. In Daniel 8:21, we read, "And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. What's interesting is there in Daniel 8:21, that Greek word, or actually it's, well, the Strong's numerical value for that Greek word Grisha there is the same Strong's number for Javan, 3120, if you were to look it up in Strong's. So it's kind of interesting. You see this association now, even scripturally, in the book of Daniel, which Daniel, though, most of it is in Chaldean, but the Strong's equivalent number there that they have equate to Grisha is the same thing as Javan, which is that, which is kind of interesting. It's the Ionian or Greek territory. Okay? So again, we ask more, who is this Tarshish? We go back to Genesis chapter 10 and read the next verse, 10 verse 5. Okay, this is more descriptions, or a little bit more descriptive definition of who these people were. 10:5 says, "From these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his own language, according to their families, into their nations." So that's quite interesting. You know, we see that then these family names that came from Javan distributed themselves to the coastland peoples, okay, and they were separated into certain lands. Okay, so continuing with Javan here is quite interesting. We see, when you look at some other writers on this, Jacinius makes a note that description of this verse denotes that it was the maritime land, whether the sea, coast, or a continent, or of an island. Another writer in the Companion Bible, Bullinger, defines this territory as the maritime countries, and many other translate the word as coastlands. Now, this is all in reference to the word isles there in verse 5. Okay, the maritime land or maritime countries being the isles of verse Genesis 10:5. Okay. Also, it's historically noted that Javan, the sons of Javan, arise from Greek and Mycenaean civilizations which occupied the Mediterranean coast and their islands. Okay. And remember, there was one other son of Javan, and that was the son Kittim. Sometimes it's spelled with a CH, I think. But what's interesting is, historically, this son is very closely associated with the country, or actually the giant island of Cyprus. Strong's offers this partial definition. It says, "Patrial from an unused name denoting Cyprus, only in the plural. A Kittite or a Cypriote, hence, is a person, an islander in general, that is, the Greeks or the Romans on the shores opposite of Palestine." And patrial means a person with a right by a statute to live in the United Kingdom and not so subject to immigration control. So it was a patrial from the unused name denoting Cyprus. Anyway, it's interesting that this word, even in Strong's, kind of associates Cyprus with being a territory that had connection with the British, okay? Because that's what that word patrial is, a British used word, okay? It means a person who by right has the statute to live in the United Kingdom and is not subject to immigration control. So I thought that was quite curious to see that use of the word in Strong's Concordance. So then another question we have to ask, okay? We know who Tarshish the person was, but then where did he actually reside? Where did he go to live? Okay, Isaiah 23, verses 6 through 7. Let's look at that. You know, we think of the history now. If you historically go back and think about who was Tarshish, his father was Javan. Okay, who was his father? His father was Japheth. Okay. Who was his father? Noah. Okay. What did Noah build? An ark. Keep that in the back of your mind. Okay? Okay. Isaiah 23, verses 6 through 7. "Pass ye over to Tarshish, how ye inhabitants of the isle. Is this your joyous city, whose antiquity is of ancient days? Her own feet shall carry her afar off to sojourn." Okay? Okay, so here we see Tarshish being aligned with the inhabitants of the isle or islands. Okay, Jonah chapter 1, verse 3. We all remember the story of Jonah. You know, he was fleeing from the presence of Yahweh. It's quite interesting. Jonah 1:3 says, "But Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish from the presence of Yahweh, and went down to Joppa, and he found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare thereof, and went down to it to go with them unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord," or from the presence of Yahweh. So we see this place was not necessarily in proximity to, you would say, the promised land. Okay? What attributes then can we assign with Tarshish? If we know that this place is an island or a place afar off, not in the presence, what other attributes go along with this place? Ezekiel 27:12. Look at that. In Ezekiel 27:12, we are told, "Tarshish was thy merchant by reason of the multitude of all kinds of riches. With silver, iron, tin, and lead, they traded in thy fairs." So we see that Tarshish was associated with merchandise. You know, they were a trading people, a trading place. Okay, let's go to Jeremiah 10, verse 9. Okay. Jeremiah 10, 9. Says, "Silver spread into plates is brought from Tarshish, and gold from Uphaz, the work of the workmen, and of the hands of the founder. Blue and purple is their clothing. They are all the work of cunning men." So here again we see then this aspect of bringing metals, particularly here in this case, silver and gold, from Tarshish, or being traded by these people of Tarshish. Now, the Tarshish itself, if you look it up in Strong's, basically it says it's a place on the Mediterranean, hence the epithet of a merchant vessel, or as one from a port. Okay. Also, another definition, let's see if I put it on here, I guess I didn't. It's a derived from that 80s of, you know, there's always you know, you got the words, their root, and then what they've been derived from. The derivation of Tarshish is from another word, Tarshish, which means a gem, perhaps the topaz or the beryl, which I thought was quite interesting, okay? A gem, and perhaps the topaz or the beryl, which also kind of gives indication that they were of trading wares, especially precious metals or precious stones. So, to me, you know, just thinking of the logical part of what were the things, attributes associated with Tarshish, you know, not only would they have to be smart about tin, metals, silver, gold, precious gems, but if they were to be seaworthy people, they have to be very good boat builders. They'd have to be able to build a boat that could sustain the seas. To me, they were in the correct family. Like I said, keep in mind who they were the grandchildren of. Tarshish was the grandchild of Japheth. And Japheth, more than likely, I would bet quite a bit of money on it, helped his father build the most, you know, notorious boat or ark that we know about, you know, which sustained the lives of 8 people and the animals. So it's quite interesting that this family is one of, that comes from this family of boat building. And what's interesting is it wasn't something that was just that Noah or Japheth, Jabin, you know, that they determined and learned it on their own. It was something that was God-given. If you go back to Genesis chapter 6, look at this. In Genesis 6, let's read verses 14 and 15. Genesis 6, 14. "Make yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark, and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. Okay? So if you continue to read down to verse 22, it tells you, you know, he's telling Noah how to build this boat. Verse 22 kind of summarizes it for us. Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. So the details of the boat building were specifically given by Yahweh himself, directly to Noah. And then, of course, Noah would have shown his children or directed his children on how to help him in this this building effort. And you can apply that to other things. You know, you look at the things dealt, say, with Solomon when he built the temple. You know, the same kind of thing happened there. David was handed the plans to the temple from Yahweh, handed down. Okay, going on to some other interesting things. Let's go back to think about Javan a little bit more. Okay, Javan, who we established earlier as settling in the area known today as Greece, also having the trade of boat or shipbuilding in their ancestry, but we also find that Javan was highly skilled in the art of metallurgy. Okay, and metallurgy is basically, you know, like an iron maker or someone that can melt metals and make things of it. Now, what's interesting is the easiest scriptural association we can see with Javan and the metallurgy is by considering the dream of Pharaoh, where he was revealed the man image of dissimilar metals. The belly and the thighs of Nebuchadnezzar's image was described as brass and is representative of the Greek Empire. That's pretty straightforward. Now, the word used in Daniel 2 more correctly denotes copper or bronze. You know, sometimes when we read in Daniel 2 of this image, we may say brass, but it actually is bronze. And so this scriptural association doubtless has its basis in the use of the metal that was used by the Greeks. Copper was the first metal to be smelted in abundance, but the real metallurgical innovation was the discovery of copper alloys. Brass is an alloy of copper and zinc. The discovery of brass would have been reasonably simple, but not so for that of bronze. An alloy of copper and of tin. Copper and tin minerals rarely occur together, and what's also interesting is there's not an abundant source of tin anywhere in the Middle East. It says, while there were many sources for copper around the Mediterranean basin, Cyprus was amongst the most important. Tin, on the other hand, was imported from places as far as the southwest Turkey, Afghanistan, and Cornwall, England. So, you know, if you think about Tarshish being a maritime people, they wouldn't have floated a boat to Afghanistan, and they could have gotten to parts of Turkey, but it's quite interesting, you know, that we can see more association with this England aspect. Now, there's another interesting twist on this as well. If you ever read about the ships in the Mediterranean, of course, you'll come across the people of the Phoenicians. Interesting enough, Tarshish means smelter in the Phoenician language. And in the many places called by this name, it was called Taros or Tortosa. And they point to the extent of this activity, that is, the smelting of metals. The main copper mines were in Cyprus, from which derives the Greek name and the term which is used today, and also Spain. The source of the tin is still controversial. Phoenician colonies like Cadiz beyond the Straits of Gibraltar point to Cornwall, England, which is indeed the only major source of tin within maritime reach of the Mediterranean region. And we would think that the Phoenicians then would have kept this tin, or this route to their tin supply, a grave secret. Okay, so that's, you know, one way to look at the aspect of the metallurgical aspect. Let's also now turn to Isaiah 2, verses 12 through 16, and look at some other examples of Tarshish and some descriptions of them. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 12. Okay, we're going to read verse 12, and then we'll skip to verse 16. The day of the Lord of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty, upon everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low. Verse 16. But the idols he shall utterly abolish. They will go into the holes of the rocks. I looked at 18, no wonder. I can't count. Upon the ships of Tarshish and upon all the beautiful sloops, the loftiness of man shall be bowed down and the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. Or that actually, it may be read in most years, and this, get to the right place here. And upon all the ships of Tarshish and upon all the pleasant pictures. Okay, so we see that this maritime people, this Tarshish, which is a proud, as we can see, and lofty people, eventually we'd be brought low. Okay, kind of keep your attention to that verse too. We're going to kind of draw another analogy back to it shortly here in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 16. This aspect of pleasant pictures or pleasant sloops. Okay, I guess when you think about it, anytime artists, I mean, this is kind of a curious thing. You know, artists a lot of times would draw. When you draw water or you paint a picture of water, what do you usually stick out there on the horizon? You know, you put a pretty picture of a ship out there. And it's, you know, quite interesting that that's definitely what way you would, well, like the first photograph I showed you here, you know, coming in my exhortation, the pictures of the great ships. Okay. Let's go now to Isaiah 23, verses 1 through 3. Isaiah 23, verses 1 through 3. It says, the burden of Tyre, howl, ye ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste, so that there is no house, no entering in from the land of Kittim, it is revealed to them. Be still, ye inhabitants of the isle, and whom the merchants of Zidon that pass over the sea have replenished. And by great waters, the sea of Sihor, the harvest of the river is her revenue, and she is a mart of nations. So here you see several associations with Tarshish. First, you see that she's associated with Tyre, okay? Tyre being a Phoenician city. Secondly, we see the association with Kittim, or Chittim, which goes back to Genesis chapter 10, okay? And then also we see then at the very end of the reading that she is a mart of nations. And also in that same verse, the third thing was the city of Zidon, Z-I-D-O-N, which is also a Phoenician city. Okay? So, if you look at a map, which is thrown up there in front, the Phoenicians, let's see if I can get this thing to work. The Phoenician territory was all this purple area, what you see around the Mediterranean. There's Cyprus is here. I think it's Cyprus here. And, you know, around the Straits of Gibraltar, northern Africa, and, of course, around Canaan, Palestine, Israel, and what would be present-day Lebanon. Okay, that's the Phoenician territory. If you were to read Isaiah chapter 23, Ezekiel chapters 26, chapter 27, and 28, you can follow the role of the latter-day Tyre by reading the complete prophecies of her in those chapters. Phoenicia was an ancient civilization centered on the north of the ancient Canaan, but its heartland along the coastal regions of modern-day Lebanon, extending to parts of Israel, Syria, and the Palestinian territories. Phoenician civilization was an enterprising maritime trading culture that spread across the Mediterranean between the period of 1550 BC to 300 BC. Though ancient boundaries of such city-centered cultures fluctuated, the city of Tyre seems to have been the most southernmost. Zidon, or Zidon, being one of Phoenicia's largest and most important cities, was located on the Mediterranean coast just approximately 23 miles north of Tyre. And both those cities today are what would be in present-day Lebanon. Okay. The scriptural prophecies of Tyre have a latter-day application, much like the prophecies of the Assyrian for the historical Israel in the land of the return, in the land when at the return of Christ. Okay, I'm going to read you a little bit of history taken from a website called MideAst.com on this Phoenician people. Okay, Phoenician Tyre was queen of the seas. She was an island city of unprecedented splendor. She grew wealthy from her far-reaching colonies and her industries of purple-dyed textiles. But she also attracted the attention of jealous conquerors, among them the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, even down to Alexander the Great. Founded at the start of the 3rd millennium BC, Tyre originally consisted of a mainland settlement and modest island city that lay a short distance off the shore. But it was not until the 1st millennium BC that the city experienced its golden age. In the 10th century BC, Hiram, king of Tyre, joined the two islands by landfill, and later he extended the city further by reclaiming a considerable area from the sea. Phoenician expansion began about 815 BC when traders from Tyre founded Carthage, which is in North Africa. Eventually, its colonies spread around the Mediterranean and Atlantic, bringing to the city a flourishing maritime trade. Okay, so this is something that could be found in his history books. You can go to history books, or you can go online and read these things. It's not something made up by Robbie Bennett. It reminds us of what we read in Ezekiel 27, verse 3. "And say unto Tyrus, O thou that art situate at the entry of the sea, which art a merchant of the people of for many isles, thus saith the Lord God, O Tyrus, thou hast said, I am of perfect beauty." Isn't that interesting? I am of perfect beauty. That's the verse I think you ought to compare back to what we read there in Isaiah a while ago. What was it? Isaiah chapter 2, verse 16. Compare that to Ezekiel 27, 3, where Tyrus says, I am of perfect beauty. But prosperity and power make their own enemies. Early in the 6th century BC, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, laid siege to the walled city for 13 years, but Tyre stood firm. It was probable that at this time the residents of the mainland city abandoned it for the safety of the island. Over time, Tyre was conquered by Alexander the Great in 332 BC. Tyre and the whole of the ancient Syria fell under Roman rule in 64 BC. Nonetheless, for some time, Tyre continued to mint its own silver coins. So even though Tyre may have changed hands as far as who they were ruled over by, whether it be Nebuchadnezzar or so forth, they continued in their maritime trade, and they even continued, as it says here, minting silver coins. During the Byzantine era, the Archbishop of Tyre was the primate of all the bishops of Phoenicia. Taken by the Islamic armies in 634, the city offered no resistance and continued to prosper under its new rulers, exporting sugar as well as objects made of pearl and glass. After the era of the Crusaders, the area passed on to the Ottomans at the start of the 16th century. With the end of World War I, Tyre was integrated into the new nation of Lebanon. So you can see it's changed hands many times, but continued as a wealthy city. Although Ezekiel's prophecy of desolation was certainly fulfilled in the original city of Tyre and her merchant polity, yet from this there must be a similar happening at the time when God sets glory in the land of the living. Glory in the land of the living belongs to the kingdom of Christ. Therefore, at the time he sets up his glory there, there is to be a Tyrian power who is to be made desolate, and as the scriptures say, to be a terrors and be no more for the Olam. Now what this is getting to, brethren, is, you know, in Ezekiel, it was prophesied of the fall of this city of Tyre. And of course they did fall, as history does show. But what we also can see is that there is that there's maybe you say an incipient fulfillment. There's an application of these fallings to that of something to occur in the latter days. Let's look, brethren, to Ezekiel chapter 26 and read about these three. There's three instances of this use of this fall or bringing a terror upon this Tyrian people. Okay, Ezekiel 26, verses 20 through 21. Okay, verse 20 says, "And I will bring you down with those who descend into the pit to the people of old, and I will make you dwell in the lowest part of the earth, in the places desolate from antiquity, with those who go down to the pit, so that you may never be inhabited, and I shall establish glory in the land of the living. I will make you a terror, and you shall be no more. Though you were sought for, you will never be found again, saith the Lord God." Okay, the second example of this is in chapter 27, verse 36. It says, "The merchants among the peoples will hiss at you. You will become a horror and be no more forever. Or thou shalt be a terror and shalt never be any more," as the King James. And the last instance is in chapter 28, verse 19. "All who knew you among the peoples are astonished at it, or astonished at you. You have become a horror and shall be no more forever." Or actually, it's just King James says, "Thou shalt be a terror and never shalt be any more." At the end of both these prophecies, the same phrase occurs that is at the end of the 26th chapter and is repeated. With it, which is repeated is, "Therefore thou shalt be terrors," and also the phrase, "and not for the Olam." Three times, therefore, there is the clear pointer that there is to be a Tyrian merchant system at the end, at the time of the end, in which the descriptions of these three chapters are to receive a further general fulfillment. A Tyrian power which is to be destroyed and have no part in the Olam or the kingdom of Messiah. It is to be astonishment or terrors when God sets his glory in the land of the living. So you say Britain is the latter day Tyre, or this the British speaking peoples. Not because, of course, she existed where Tyre existed, but because she inherits and manifests Tyre's characteristics. You know, we've talked about all the characteristics of Tyre, a maritime people, you know, trading in wares, a very prosperous people. And therefore, if Tyre was able to fall, so shall this British people as well. It is clear beyond a doubt that Tyre's character is the character of Britain. And Tyre's fall typifies the fall from esteem and world influence of the British system. You know, and I think, brethren, we have been seeing this fall coming really heavily in the last several months. I think it started well before then, but we can see that this British system will eventually come to a point where they are of no esteem in the eyes of the world, especially at the time of Christ's return. Okay, here's some other thoughts. This burden against Tyre is a very valuable prophecy that God has allowed to come down to us through the scriptures of truth. This prophecy is particularly useful in correcting that attitude common today where some regard Britain as having some special status in the eyes of God. Britain is thought of as working for God and being on the right side in time of war. Although temporarily astray, she is thought of as the defender of God's people and having an honorable part to play when Christ is here. This is a popular verse to go to, Isaiah chapter 60, verse 9, which says, makes note that the ships of Tarshish first bring thy sons from afar unto the name of the Lord thy God. Now, brethren, I would suggest that this, you know, when you look at the Isaiah chapter 60, it's all, that chapter pretty much is talking about the kingdom age. And sometimes those verses are applied to things that have happened historically in the setting up or the establishment of the nation of Israel in 1947-48. Might be a possible application, but I think the true application is still yet to come. These sentiments have been expressed many times since 1917, but such sentiments must be reconciled with the prophecies of Isaiah and Ezekiel concerning Tyre and Britain. In God's eyes, Britain is a harlot full of iniquity and violence, prostituting her honor for commercial gain, and the judgments of the present century upon her are to be increased. Her trading system, which is her very lifeblood, is to be broken, and she is to be dependent upon the mercy of the new king in Zion for the continuance of her life as a subject people. And I think, you know, we're beginning to see some of that in the media as we watch day-to-day things going on. Now, of course, Britain, we know in history, has been a defender of God's people. Besides Brother Thomas and other Christadelphian writers, some Bible students have seen Britain as being the main Protestant power fostering the return of the Jews. For example, in 1797, Thomas Witherby, in commenting upon the book The Restoration of the Jews, A Crisis of All Nations, he believed that England, under a new Cyrus, would be chosen to perform God's purpose of mercy towards Israel. Okay? Let's turn to Isaiah 49 and let's read a few verses there. Isaiah 49. We'll read verse 1 and then we'll skip to verses 22 and 23. Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from far. The Lord hath called me from the womb, from the bowels of my mother. He hath made mention of my name. Verse 22. Thus saith the Lord, the Lord God, behold, I will lift up my hand to the Gentiles, and set up my standard to the people, and they shall bring thy sons in their arms, and thy daughters shall be carried upon their shoulders. And kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and their queens thy nursing mothers. And they shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth and lick up the dust of thy feet, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me. So here you can almost see some things indicating these isle people being nursing and helping those people that would live in Israel, you know, supporting the Israel system. No one is suggesting that Britain has never or ever been a truly Bible-based nation, but we do know that it has done more than any other nation on earth to promote Bible reading and taking its message to the ends of the earth. Consider for a moment the Bible translation work of Wycliffe and even Tyndale. We know that it was the work of those in Britain which brought about the existence of what we currently use for the Bible, and that is the King James authorized version of the Bible. So we can see that the British people have played a prominent role in, I guess you might say, witnessing God's Word. In November 1917, before Britain had conquered Jerusalem and the area known then to be Palestine, they issued forth a proclamation we're all familiar with called the Balfour Declaration. This declaration was a letter addressed to Lord Rothschild based on a request of the Zionist organization that was established in Great Britain. So, when on the topic of defender of Israel, Tarshish or the British nation and her allies are seen to act on behalf of the welfare of Israel in history, and I think it will be so forth in the coming days ahead. You know, of course, this is the most popular verse to us all when we think about Tarshish, Ezekiel 38:13. Let's turn and look at that. Ezekiel 38:13. we read. Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish and all their young lions will say to you, have you come to take a plunder? Have you gathered your army to take a spoil, to take away silver and gold, to take away livestock and goods, to take a great plunder? Okay, so here we see this British people acting as, or this Tarshish nation acting as a protectorate, in a sense, to the onslaught of the Confederated Nations against Israel. Of course, we know in that case, you know, they're unable, it's basically just a question. You know, what are you doing? Are you coming forth to take a spoil? They don't actually come forth and fight, and they only ask the question. Now, this verse ties back in Ezekiel 38, brings in one more piece of the puzzle, and that is the aspect of the young lions. Okay? Here we are able to explain that the eastern and western Tarshish of the prophet's day point to both India, or their pursuits in India and Britain. That the phrase, the young lions, very appropriately describes the British family of nations. Okay? Now here's some interesting posters that you can go back and historically find. And if you just go and use Google, for instance, on the internet, and you type in, you know, Britain and young lions on their pictures, these are some of the things you will find. So it's quite interesting that Britain has a lion, or associate herself as a mother lion, and you can see in the center photo that you can see the young lions at her side. You know, these were posters used to help get people interested in enlisting in the armies in past times, especially the center one. But you can notice the one there on the left-hand side, the lion with all the flags, and you can see the different flags, which would be Australia. Let's see, what all are they? I don't know if I wrote them down or not. Basically, they're the supporting nations. Okay, let me pick up more of my notes. I can't go off the cuff very well. Okay, Tarshish and Tyre are also linked together in Isaiah chapter 23. Tyre is called the daughter of Tarshish, okay? That's which is quite interesting. The daughter of Tarshish, Isaiah 23, verse 10. Okay? There is no doubt that the British power is represented both by Tyre and Tarshish in the latter days. So if you go to Isaiah 23, verse 1, we read this. The burden of Tyre, how, ye ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste, so that there is no house, no entering in from the land of Kittim, it is revealed to them. Skip down to verse 10. Pass through thy land as a river, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more strength. So there you kind of get the indication of that family association, the daughter of Tarshish. That being, you know, the association with the burden of Tyre. Just like the young lions being the children of this mother. We've already talked about how the destruction of the British merchant system is foreshadowed in Ezekiel's prophecy concerning Tyre and how it shall fall. But also Isaiah describes the same destruction, but relates this actually to Tarshish. If you look at Isaiah chapter 2, verse 16, let's read that. Isaiah 2, verse 16, we'll see the same type of fall projected. I think we read this earlier, actually. We have to go back, remember, up to verse 10, 11. Enter the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of Yahweh and the glory of his majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty, and upon everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low. Upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon all the oaks of Bashan, and upon all the high mountains, upon all the hills that are lifted up, and even upon every high tower and every fortified wall, and upon the ships of Tarshish, and upon the beautiful pictures or sloops, which apply to boats. Okay, let's also then look at Isaiah chapter 23, verse 14. Wail, ye ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. And then lastly, let's look at Psalm 48, verse 7. Speaking of this fall and demise of this Tarshish system. Psalm 48, verse 7. Start at verse 6. Fear took hold of them there, and pain as of a woman in travail, as when you break the ships of Tarshish with an east wind. This is usually interpreted as a naval disaster, but if interpreted literally, it must mean that God causes a mighty gale to destroy their fleet. But the words are meant to express more than just a naval disaster. The ships of Tarshish are a figure for the British mercantile power, and the east wind is a figure for an eastern Mediterranean power which shall be hostile or shall govern over that of Britain. The context of this verse in Isaiah shows it is not to be understood literally, but the day of Yahweh the host is upon all the cedars of Lebanon, even the oaks of Bashan, as we read, even the high mountains, as well as upon the ships of Tarshish. God's anger will not be upon literal trees and mountains in that day, but upon the nations and empires represented by these figures. And if the trees and mountains are symbols, so then are the ships. And we know that God, of course, or Christ, when he returns, will elevate himself and his power over the nations around, the nations of all the earth. We read in Psalm 72, verses 1 to 2, that Tarshish does surrender to the command of Christ. Let's look at that. Psalm 72, verses 1 and 2. Give the king your judgment, O God, and your righteousness to the king's son. He will judge your people with righteousness, and the poor with justice. Let's skip to verse 10. The kings of Tarshish and all the isles will bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba will offer gifts. Yes, all kings shall fall down before him. All nations shall serve him. Also, we read in Isaiah chapter 60 that it tells us that when the Gentiles come to the brightness and glory of Israel's restoration under the Messiah, then the isles of the Gentiles will wait on him, and the ships of Tarshish will be first and foremost in the work of transporting Israel's sons as a gift of tribute. A gift of tribute which will be brought before the King of the Jews. This is to be their mission in the latter days, and they will fulfill it. So, brethren, we see that still this British nation will have an important part to play in the kingdom of God. But first, they'll have to come under the command of Christ. It should be recognized that Isaiah 69 has already had what sometimes is called an incipient fulfillment. The ships of Tarshish were represented by the British when they issued the Balfour Declaration in November of 1917. They were first in leading the events towards the creation of a national home for the Jewish people. The British Mandate period in Palestine, as it was called, in spite of all its failures and the evasion of its provisions, paved the way for the birth of the state of the nation of Israel. It was, however, a first stage merely, for the more complete implementation of the prophecy is yet to be realized at the return of Christ. Now, just in quick review, these are the things which can help us to understand who Tarshish is. We found from Genesis 10 that they were from the family of Japheth or Javan, which applies to the land of Greece. In Genesis 10:5, we read that they were of the isles of the Gentiles. They were people that moved to the coastlands. In Jonah chapter 1, verse 3, we found that it was a long way from Israel, or it was not in the presence of Yahweh. In Isaiah 23, we learn that this nation or these people were sea traders. From Ezekiel 27, we found that they were in the business of trading metals. We read several places that they were a maritime power. In Isaiah 23, we found that they traded to a multinational market. In Isaiah 23, we can realize that they, or this British nation, or Tarshish, will take on the role of the latter-day Tyre. We know from Isaiah 60, verse 9, that they have assisted in the regathering of the Jews in history, but they shall fulfill this prophecy of Isaiah greater, or to its actual manifestation, in the future age. We know in Ezekiel 38 that they oppose the northern confederated armies that come against Israel. We read in Psalm 72 that they are associated with other island powers. But we also read in Isaiah 2 that they are a nation or a people that shall be humbled. And we learn from Psalm 72 that they are to surrender unto the Christ, the King of the earth, at his return. So, you ask yourself, what then is the scriptural identity of the Tarshish and the young lions, as we might read Ezekiel 38? Well, the biblical ships of Tarshish are represented by Great Britain and the young lions, which include nations such as the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, India, and others. And those were all those national flags that you saw earlier on that other poster. So, brethren, there's a lot more detail that we could go through. Like I said, we've pretty much taken up our time. I would suggest if you can get your hands on a copy of this, there's a lot more interesting reading as well there that will help you through understanding who Tarshish actually is. That concludes the lecture. Let's now have our memorial.